Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Tonight we are here, as I said, to think about earthquakes. We have a panel of very distinguished guests, and we're also here to celebrate the publication of the LA Earthquake Source Book, which you will be hearing more about. It's truly an amazing volume, a very rich, rich resource for our city and for the world. I'm going to just make brief introductions of our panelists and then turn it over to our moderator, Judith Lewis. We do have the LA Source Book for sale, courtesy of the library store, as well as David Ulan's book on the fault line on earthquakes, so that is for sale also. We're not going to have a formal book signing, but our panelists will be around in the lobby afterwards if you would like to have them sign their essay or their book. After the panel discussion and presentations, we will open up to you. Please wait until the microphone comes to you. As I said, we do record for podcasts, and we welcome your questions of the panel tonight. So, onwards. Our panel consists of, first of all, the moderator, Judith Lewis, who is a contributing editor at High Country News, and Judith's writing on technology, the arts, natural resource issues, public health, and the environment appeared for many years in the Los Angeles Weekly and has appeared in many other publications. She's a member of the Society for Environmental Journalists and is currently at work on A Layperson's Guide to Nuclear Energy. Mariano Amatullo is the co-founder and director of the college-wide Initiative Design Matters. She is the vice president of the International Initiatives Department at Art Center College of Design, based in Pasadena. Through her leadership, Art Center is the first design institution to be formally affiliated with the UN as a non-governmental organization. And Mariana acted as the director of the Los Angeles Earthquake Get Ready Project. Michael Deere is professor of geography and urban planning at USC, an honorary professor in the Bartlett School of Planning at University College London. His book, The Postmodern Urban Condition, was selected by Choice Magazine as an outstanding academic title, and his work has appeared in many publications. Many of you will recognize Dr. Lucy M. Jones as that reassuring presence on television in the wake of any kind of a tremor. Dr. Jones has been a seismologist with the U.S. Geological Survey and a visiting research associate at the Seismological Laboratory of Caltech since 1983. She is currently serving as the chief scientist for the Multi-Hazards Initiative in Southern California, developing a new program to integrate hazard science in urban areas with economic analysis and emergency response to increase community resiliency to natural disasters. You know, if anything happens tonight, we are really in good company. Dr. Dennis S. Maletti is Professor Emeritus at the University of Colorado at Boulder, where he serves as the Chair of the Department of Sociology and as Director of the Natural Hazard Center, the United States Clearinghouse for Social and Behavioral Science Research on Hazards and Disasters. He's the author of over 100 publications, primarily discussing the societal aspects of hazards and disasters. He was the founder and co-editor in chief of the All Hazards, All Disciplines journal, the Natural Hazards Review. He has served on a variety of advisory boards, including the National Institute of Standards and Technology's Expert Advisory Panel for the Study of the Evacuation of the World Trade Center Towers on September 11th, and the American Society of Civil Engineers Expert Panel overseeing the Army Corps of Engineers assessment of the New Orleans levee failures. And last but not least, David L. Ulan, who is book editor of the Los Angeles Times and the author of the wonderful book, The Myth of Solid Ground, Earthquakes, Prediction, and the Fault Line Between Reason and Faith. He's also the editor of Another City, Writing from Los Angeles, and Writing Los Angeles, a Literary Anthology. His work appears in many publications, and he is an anchor of the LA literary community. Please welcome our distinguished panel, and I will turn it over to Judith Lewis. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming tonight. I think we have a really interesting panel lined up, especially in light of our 3.1 earthquake today that was centered in Reseda, which gets everybody thinking about earthquakes. We're going to start out with a three-minute introduction from each of the panelists, and then I'll move on to ask some questions, and then we'll turn it over to the audience for a question and answer session. So we're going to start with Dr. Lucy Jones, who's going to show us an animation of the potential earthquake.
I thought Judith asked me to talk a bit about the science of earthquakes and believing in the reality. I actually think we don't have trouble in Southern California convincing people that we have earthquakes. The issue is helping them understand what that means for them. And so we have, over the last year, developed a scenario of a major San Andreas earthquake, and this is actually an animation that will show what the shaking is like. And this is what we used for the Great Southern California Shakeout that was held in November, and is also where I got involved with the Art Center and doing a lot more working with the social science side of understanding what earthquakes are like. In this animation, you're seeing what would happen with the San Andreas earthquake. That's what we're seeing on the left is a map of the San Andreas Fault, running from down by the Salton Sea near the Mexican border up past Los Angeles. And we modeled this earthquake that began at the southern end of the fault and is rupturing up the fault. One thing is a big earthquake is longer than a small earthquake, but they still start at the same point and they travel at 2 miles a second. So we're already now 40 seconds into the earthquake and the very first P wave, which you're now seeing as the purple, the very first not very strong wave is arriving in downtown Los Angeles. The Coachella Valley has already been devastated by this event. We're now 55 seconds into the earthquake, and you see the red, which is the strongest levels of shaking and the highest level of damage, has come through San Bernardino and is now heading into the Los Angeles area. We might have thought that because the fault is so far away from Los Angeles, we wouldn't have had a lot of damage in Los Angeles itself. However, as you're going to be seeing here, because the Los Angeles Basin is essentially the geological equivalent of a bowl of jello. It's big, hard rock and then very loose sediment on which we've built our city. And you can see when the waves come through that, they get larger because they slow down going through that soft material, and they have to get larger then to carry the same amount of energy. Not only that, but they begin to resonate. And so we essentially have a big bowl, a rock bowl in which we've built our city, and we're actually seeing the waves coming off of the, coming through the basin and then echoing back across it. And so notice that we're now 2 minutes into this earthquake. This is how a really big earthquake is so different from a small one. It lasts for a much longer time and affects a much larger area. And this is what we've been trying to help people comprehend as we went through the shakeout, is that if you're ready for Northridge, that doesn't mean you're ready for this. And that getting, this is a really different type of experience where instead of having 500,000 people at strong shaking like we had in Northridge, we'll have 10 million people at strong shaking. And it's a time when we are really going to have to work together, and what our lives will be like after the big earthquake will depend both on what we've done to prepare ourselves, but also what our community's done. And we see it as a really direct result straight out of the science of understanding what makes a big earthquake.
Thanks. That was such a perfect setup to set the tone of the evening, I think, so you all see what we're dealing with. Mariana Amatullo is the director of the LA Earthquake Sourcebook Project, which all of us worked on in some capacity, and she's going to give a little talk about that project.
Yes, thank you, Judith, and good evening. It's a pleasure to be here tonight, and I'd like to thank again Louise Steinman and her team for putting this session together tonight. What I thought I would do in just briefly a couple of minutes is give you a little bit of insight on how we put this publication together and show you some of the images and work in the book very, very quickly. And before I do that, let me start by saying this was the book is part of a larger effort. It was a three-year-long process we led at Art Center College of Design shortly after Hurricane Katrina, where with the former president of the school, Richard Koshalek, we looked at how can we think about disasters and the intersection between disaster and design. And as an institution of design at Art Center, how can we involve our community, our creative community, in making a contribution to anticipate what would be a large-scale disaster in our own neighborhood and backyards. And of course, in Los Angeles, that means quakes. It was a real pleasure for me to be involved in this project. This was the brand, the identity of the initiative, which was designed by Stefan Zeigmeister, who is also the designer of our source book. And it involved an amazing team of staff, faculty, students, alumni at our center. And I want to acknowledge briefly a couple of contributors that are in the audience: Erica Clark, my colleague and co-founder of Design Matters, who's in the audience, and of course Gloria Gerais, the managing editor of this publication, without whom we would have not been able to get here today. As I said earlier, the book was part of a three-prong initiative where we basically compiled a lot of research over a year of conversations, interviews, and spending a lot of time with experts such as Lucy and Dennis and Michael and others, and then decided to put all that expertise in one volume, utilizing a very visual approach and looking at design as a conduit to bring very different voices and expertise together. So having emergency management, having policymakers, having government represented in this book. And it was challenging in that we had, with this wonderful editorial team, with Judith, David, and Aileen Farnan Antonier, who's not here tonight, we had to go back to a lot of the research and curate these different voices, produce a manuscript that then we gave to a team of students at the school and commissioned a few pieces from alumni from Art Center and said, can you interpret these different scientific pieces and come up with an engaging, different piece? And of course, David will talk later. He curated a whole series of fiction pieces that are in the source book. And as you can see, this team of students produced a lot of work. And then Stefan Zeigmeister curated a very small selection, from a lot of the work that was produced at the school over 14 weeks. So that was our process. Here's a piece by Paul Rogers, who's a faculty member at the school and a very well-known and wonderful illustrator. I encourage you all to look at the book closely. We are very excited to, again, have a very different approach, we believe, in this manual. This is Christopher Niemann, a wonderful illustrator based in New York. And all the work you see is work from our students at the school. So our goal with this book and the initiative overall, I would say, and we can talk more about it later, was, again, how do we bridge, how do we bring through creativity, through design education, a different perspective, and one that hopefully can really motivate the public to want to learn more and to care and be more empowered and more resilient when the big one strikes. Thank you.
Thanks. Michael, you can stay at the table as long as you don't have a PowerPoint to deliver, and the rest of us can do the same. So, Go ahead.
Thank you very much for the introduction and welcome to everybody. I want to say that I think this is truly a beautiful piece of work. The book is wonderful, but it doesn't compare with the video that we've just seen. I'm now truly terrified.
Right.
And no, I'm not prepared. I'm sure all you are, but not me. I'd like to turn the attention away from the actual event and maybe start thinking about how we prepare. It was pointed out already that there's an important role for social science and others to play, as well as the scientists in the exercise. And one of the things that I'd like to do is just to put in your mind what I think is probably the most important thing that we should be worrying about right now, and that is to say the role of government in preparedness. I want to think a little bit outside the box, and it seems singularly appropriate to do that now, given the inauguration yesterday. What is the proper role of government in earthquake preparedness? We all saw the tragic images from Katrina not so long ago, and an idiot getting applauded by the president for the work that he was not doing in terms of rescuing people there. President Obama said yesterday that government is not a question about whether it's too large or too small. The question is whether or not it works. And that's the question which I want to address for a moment, partly because we're in a situation, I think, where over the last couple of decades we've moved towards a more privatized world. And the key word in my estimation in this problem is privatization. It's a hollowing out of government. It's a cutting back of programs. It's a starving of funds that goes there. It also is accompanied by the appointment of manifestly incompetent people in charge of agencies who consequently then do nothing. I mean, we've only got ourselves to blame in a lot of ways for some of the disasters that we've encountered in the recent past, and I fear that's going to be the situation in the future, which is why I'm drawing attention to it now, and so I hope forcefully. Just think about it for a moment. We've had fires, a lot of fires. We always do have a lot of fires in Southern California. And in San Diego, most recently, the most striking thing that occurred to me is the number of private firefighters who are out there doing good works, preventing properties from burning, preventing the loss of life. This isn't a county where the taxpayers have consistently voted for many years not to support a tax increase, to support public firefighting. The answer? Then we all go to our own private arrangements and make sure that we're safe, and to hell with the rest of everybody else around us. Another example, the other example, I guess, is private cities. We see more and more these days that people are gating their communities and putting political boundaries around them. Something I think 15% of the housing stock in this country right now is a kind of a private community. And more Americans are living in them. This is what my friend Evan McKenzie calls privatopia. Las Vegas is leading the way. They have deliberately doing away with the municipal government there in favor of privatized arrangements for communities. Now, you might not think much of this, and you might, in fact, support it. But when things go wrong, there's no private agency coming in to clear this up, you see. What happens is that private communities then turn to the public sector, to adjacent municipalities, to adjacent governments for their solutions. Now, and if this goes on, you can imagine an earthquake situation where one gated community is fighting another gated community, is ignoring the rights of the people in between. And Octavia Butler, in a very wonderful novel called Parable of the Sower, not so long ago, wrote about a dystopia in Southern California where community had devolved into private communities at war with each other. People would literally scale wars and kill for a fresh lemon. Under these circumstances, we should be talking more about what community obligations are, not what community rights are, not what individual rights are. Because I think that, let me put this scenario to you to go along with the scenario that we've already seen of the ground shaking dramatically underneath us. Earthquake readiness is one thing that I really, really do approve of. And this book is full of very good ideas that I haven't thought about. And I regard myself as a relatively well-informed person. So I have cash on hand. I have a flashlight. I have shoes by the bed. I will have water, et cetera, et cetera. The thing that truly worries me, however, is not that I will have these on hand or not, but I don't want to be confronted in some dim, dark corner at 3:20 a.m. when this thing strikes, and find that my well-armed neighbors from the community across the street prefer my brand of bottled water to theirs. Neither do I want us in Los Angeles to be faced with a future in some time when we go cap in hand to some global corporation now headquartered in Dubai and beg for assistance from that mega corporation, which is answerable solely to its shareholders and not to any kind of constituents. So don't pray for preparedness. Demand that the government actually does what it's supposed to do. Thank you.
Thank you. David.
I am not a policy person. I come to this more from a kind of sociology aspect, psychological or psychology aspect. The book that I wrote about earthquakes, I described once as a study of the metaphysics of seismology, which explains its vast commercial success. But what I'm interested in, I think all of this is really interesting. What I'm interested in is psychological preparation, because I think that everything that you've heard here is significant and important. It's important to be physically prepared. It's important to do what is necessary in terms of water, in terms of money, in terms of self-protection. It's important to think about the role of private and public sector. But I also think that it's important for people who live in an earthquake region or in any kind of natural disaster zone to think about what it requires to live in such a region. And I actually think that in the age of terror, every place is every place has always been a potential disaster region. The one thing we know is that everything moves towards entropy. But now we live in a culture where that has become front and center in terms of how we think of the world and our place in it, where we are aware of kind of the fragility of social structures, the fragility of cities, the fragility of government, the fragility of families, the fragility of everything. And what interests me is how do we prepare for that as people? What is the psychological as well as physical preparations that we undertake? How does this place, with its physical instability, imprint itself upon us, and what does it mean in terms of our personalities? I started writing about earthquakes because they scared me, and I wanted to, because that scared me, and it still scares me. But I wanted to kind of wrap my mind around it, to understand how one could live in this place, and how one dealt with moving forward in the face of uncertainty. For some people, it's a matter of simply taking all the physical precautions you can and then saying, okay, I'm ready. For some people, I think it is a matter of denial. I think there are a lot of people for whom preparation is denial. In the course of researching the book, I spoke to a guy at one point who worked in terms of disaster relief, and he said, hey, you know, there's such a thing as healthy denial. If you don't have an element of healthy denial, you couldn't possibly live here because you'd be waiting for the earthquake to come every second of the day. So I think that that's also something that's important for us to think about. I'm also interested in storytelling and how stories help give us meaning or create a context in which we can find meaning. That's why one of the things that I did for the book was to curate a selection of writings, of literary writings on earthquakes, because I think that there's, in a universe of chaos, which is fundamentally what I philosophically believe is the universe we live in, a universe without any inherent meaning, a universe without any inherent narrative. The one thing that people do for themselves individually first and then for the culture that they're part of is to construct narratives, personal narratives, collective narratives, narratives that make sense. Part of what we're talking here in terms of all sorts of preparation is a narrative. There's a physical preparation narrative. The narrative Michael is talking about is what kind of cultural narrative or political narrative or governmental narrative do we want to be part of? And I think that the first thing that we need to do is to imagine ourselves into a story and imagine what that story is. And so that people's reaction to earthquakes, whether it's fear, whether it's excitement, whether it's preparation, whether it's denial, are all part of that package. One of the things that struck me recently is this phrase, deliberate calm, which was used to describe the pilot who landed the plane in the Hudson River last week. Which is something that pilots apparently develop. through training so that when the shit hits the fan, they don't panic. They sort of literally will themselves, well, I shouldn't say will themselves because it is a matter of training, to remain calm. They're in a state of heightened anxiety, but they have a veneer of deliberate calm. And I think that one of the things that we develop or need to develop living in an earthquake culture is that same kind of deliberate calm. How do we take the precautions we need and then tell ourselves a story in which our lives are not chaotic, in which they make sense, in which there is a kind of a framework or a larger context that we can fit into? And I think that what interests me is, what are the natures of those stories? There are many different stories, as there are different people who are telling themselves these stories. Some of them are fantasies, some of them aren't. But in some ways, they all fit together into a larger psychological or sociological context, which I think is at the root of all of the other stuff.
Thank you. So, Dennis, don't give it all away, because your research is really fascinating, and we're going to get right back to a question about your research, so I promise.
She said that because she knows I'll say what I want. I'd like to thank the people in Los Angeles and at the library here for inviting a sociologist here tonight. I'm actually old enough to remember when not many people cared what a sociologist might say. And that's certainly not true anymore. One of the biggest problems regarding earthquakes, perhaps the biggest problem regarding earthquakes, has nothing to do with ground shaking. It has to do with how people who are exposed to the risk of earthquakes perceive that risk and what they do and don't do, either as individuals or in groups, government, communities, etc., about the risk they face. Psychologists and sociologists have been on the university campuses of this nation for 100 years trying to understand human beings. And now that I've retired and no longer seek federal funds for research myself, I'm going to declare, we understand people. We know how they're wired, and we know why they do what they do when they do it. In reference to disasters like earthquakes, sociologists have been studying human beings and their response to those sorts of events for half a century. We understand, predict with great confidence, over and over again, how people behave when catastrophes they've never experienced occur, and we're right. We've also focused, me in particular, on the topic of how it is that some people get ready for events that in their heart and soul they believe aren't really going to happen, and if they do, are going to happen to somebody else. And we've pieced together knowledge on that question over the decades. Some of the initial ideas and revelations and breakthroughs came in small California communities. And our federal government, 3 or 4 years ago, funded the Manhattan Project equivalent in the social and behavioral sciences on how to motivate people in their homes to get ready for disaster. And that project just got completed. And I want to tell you what the results were.
And you will get to.
I'm not done.
Okay.
The researchers were able to explain almost 50% of the variation in preparedness behavior with all Americans in the country, for white Americans, and separate from that, African Americans and Asian and Pacific Islanders and Hispanics. If you're a social scientist, you'd have goosebumps now to think that we finally nailed something. We actually now know and are able to recommend to those who have the ability to do it how to go about motivating people like you and me to get ready. for what Lucy showed you. And I hope I have a chance to talk more about that later this evening.
You promise that you will. To me, there are three parts to this discussion. One is how we prepare in advance for an earthquake. The other is how we actually deal with the earthquake once it happens. And also how our community recovers from the earthquake, whether our city is resilient enough, our community is resilient enough and sufficiently prepared, and then what happens in the aftermath, how much private services are relied upon to save us in the aftermath, and how many public sector services will come to our rescue. So I would like to start with preparedness, and I would like to start. We can see the audience pretty well from here. Could I see a show of hands of how many people feel they're sufficiently prepared for a potential earthquake? And these are people who actually came voluntarily to a discussion about earthquakes. So as I go around and talk to people, I find, and when we were working on the book, we would talk to people and say, are your bookshelves secured? Do you have water to last a few days? Do you have cash and small bills? Are you prepared? And people would say no. So one of the things I'd like to explore a little bit, and I know you all have things to say about this, is why we don't prepare. Yes, Lucy.
Should I put up the slides from the shake-up?
That would be great. Yeah. So Lucy has slides from the shakeout, which was the November 13th event that I have a very difficult time describing, even when I'm putting in print, because so many agencies, corporations, NGOs, nonprofits, community organizations, schools were involved that I believe the people who designed the project have lost track of what the results were because they just sent it out to so many people to be involved. But it was, do you want to talk a little bit about, describe it, the shakeout, briefly what it is? And
Well, how many of you were aware of the shakeout when it happened in November? Okay, yeah, pretty much everyone. Right. And it came out of developing this scenario of what a big earthquake would be like and working with the range of people down the table to understand not just what it would physically do, but what it would do to our society. And then talking with Dennis about how you communicate this to people and get them to use it. And from that, we developed the campaign. And it's to carry this message that, there's individual preparedness, and that was what we had focused on mostly, but that what life will be like for us as a community depends what we do as individuals, what we do as a community, and what your neighbor does. And that's not something Americans like very much. Whether or not, I lose money in this earthquake is going to depend partly on whether what my neighbor's done. If he chooses to not retrofit his house and it falls down and it's an abandoned wreck after the earthquake, I've just lost property value. And that's a simple version, but everything in this is all, we're all in this together, the system works together, and that means the solution has to be done together. And that was sort of the motivation behind the shakeout.
And so these are slides from that day. There's a man ducking and covering and holding on, which is
It's actually not a big change, but it's something that we didn't work at communicating.
In schools,
everybody was told to duck and cover, and then it became drop cover, and then it became drop cover and hold on, keep the table on top of you as the earthquake tries to pull it away. But the Red Cross used to talk about going to doorways because one of their people saw a completely destroyed adobe house with the door frame still standing and said, gosh, that must be a good place to be, which is true if you live in a 200-year-old adobe house. And then, of course, there's been this sort of viral phenomenon of the triangle of life that's pulled people away. And what we saw with the Chino Hills earthquake this summer is that most Californians did not do drop, cover, hold on. And when there were interviews and people didn't know it. So we decided, we turned a bit on what we had been planning with the shakeout and really focused on that drill. It was a concrete thing to do, made it a simple message. We could be consistent in our messaging and seemed to be something that Southern Californians needed.
And this relates right back to Dennis's research because we know that most people don't prepare, but we do know that some people prepare. And one of the things that was really fascinating to me that you found out was what differentiates the people who prepare from those who don't prepare.
You'll find research publications that say things like this. Women are more inclined to prepare than men. Whites are more inclined to prepare than non-whites, etc. don't believe a word of it. Those differences disappear when you implement complex statistical models. Three things matter, and only three things. Count them. One, two, three. This is what distinguishes those who prepare and those who don't, and this is how you motivate people to prepare. Number one, the factor that does the biggest job to motivate people in America and California to prepare is seeing other people prepare. In other words, monkey see, monkey do. It also explains why we wear the clothes we wear and why we buy the cars we buy. And so one of the most significant things any of us as individuals or government or NGOs, etc., could do is get preparedness out of the closet and into the streets so people can copy it. Number two is also an information factor. People need information about how to prepare. Now, I hate to say this again in front of Lucy because I've already done it three times and this is the fourth. If you talk to people about the risk of earthquakes and that they're going to be big, they turn off and tune out. What you need to talk about is what there is to do to prepare. If you want someone to prepare, you need to tell them how to prepare. How many of you have ever raised a little boy? Okay, so if it's just like teaching a little boy how to tie a shoe. It goes something like this. No, 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 that shoe goes on the other foot. And this is how you tie the bow, now you try it. You didn't explain to the kid how his toes would turn black and need to be amputated if he walked on snow and ice, or how he'd get blistered walking barefoot on sidewalks in Palm Springs in summer. You focused on the behavior you wanted the person to do. Well, all those little boys grew up, and so did the girls, and they're the people we're trying to help get ready for earthquakes. So you need to tell people what to do, but you can't say it once and expect it to take. You have to repeat it over and over and never stop saying it. And the more the diversity in channels they get that message, if they get it on a bag from their grocer, the kids come home from school with coloring books about it, they hear it on TV, they see it on the radio, there's a bumper sticker that talks about it. When you walk in the library, there's a display of the kinds of supplies they should have at home, like that. In other words, you need to sell it the way you sell Coca-Cola. And then the third thing, and the three that really get people to prepare, people need to talk about it with each other. People don't do anything until they talk it over with people in their life. It's kind of like this. Hey, what do you think about that? Are you doing it? Which is how you decide to buy a car and how you decide to move, etc. And so if we could focus our work to motivate the public to prepare, focusing on those three things, we actually would make a difference. Now, what that means, just one more minute, because I enjoy picking on Lucy. We're actually good friends. You may have heard the slogan, "Let's talk about our faults." That comes from Lucy and I having a beer one night. And I suggested to her that people needed to talk about this as a precursor to them doing something about it. So she put the part in, "Let's talk about," and then added "our faults" because she's a seismologist. And I said, no, 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 it's not "let's talk about our faults," it's "let's talk about what to do about our faults."
I just want you to know that I've interviewed Dr. Jones many times over the last 2 years, and that nugget of information about don't tell people just what's going to happen, tell them what to do about it, I first heard from her. So evidently you're repeating it over and over, finally got through your...
We have a lot of beers.
I do need to respond to this because indeed, I have heard it more than once, but also If you notice, we listened when we put together the shakeout. Visual reinforcement, we did everything we could to turn it into a media event. And that wasn't because we love to be out in front of the media. It's a way of giving everybody in Los Angeles that visual image and get it out of the closet. Here are people preparing. And then the other aspect of milling, to be able to talk about it with people you care about. That was the motivation behind asking, trying to get everybody to drill at the same moment. The idea would be that a child would come home from school and say, "Mommy, I had an earthquake drill today." And mommy says, "You know, I had an earthquake drill at work today, too." And daddy goes, "You know, I had one, too." And it becomes something that you start talking about. So it was an explicit effort to use the sociology in the way in which we put this together. And I want to tell you that this is from Mark Benthian, one of our main activists here, who went to a meeting of LA Unified, and a teacher was talking about it and said, "You know, my daughter came home from school and said, I had an earthquake drill today, and I told her that I had one too." So exactly what we had said we wanted to do, and it seems to have happened at least in some places.
And let me just add, you know, from a communication and visual perspective, what was brilliant about ShakeOut, I think, having been part of it as well for the school, was that it was not a gloom and doom scenario. There was really an effort to make this contemporary in all of the different media that was used, and positive and empowering for people to have something to do, know what to do, and celebrate it.
Mariana, when you started planning the LA Earthquake Sourcebook, did you know about Dennis's research?
Well, it was one of the first things I learned about. I've had a crash course on earthquakes through the project, and it's been an honor to learn about Dennis's work right away, yes.
Mm-hmm. And maybe you could talk just a little bit about what motivated the book and as part of this information campaign and the involvement with USGS.
Well, I think what was very important to us was to, again, use design and communications and the expertise we have at our center as a conduit to try to bring this information together in a way that would be more accessible and uplifting for the public, for a more general public. And within a year of working on the project, we had the good fortune to start having these conversations with Lucy and others about how can we align this and make it part of ShakeOut. So we were very involved in the Great Southern California ShakeOut. It was a designer from our center that came up with the logo, a website portal, and then we collaborated very closely, which was one of the great joys of the project, bringing this cross-cultural expertise and being a little bit the unusual suspects in this very prestigious group of policymakers and scientists and emergency managers to bring that creative perspective to the ShakeOut effort. We had the Get Ready rally on Friday of that week, which was culminated very close from here at LA Live, Nokia Center. And that was an effort to come together with earthquake information and vendors and information in a very public space in Los Angeles and invite the public to come convene and talk about the drill and what had just happened the day before.
One of the pieces that emerged from the book, from my experience working on the book, and I think for all of us, is that private contribution, the private sector's contribution to preparedness, to rebuilding the city in the aftermath, to taking care of people in the immediate aftermath, versus how much we can rely on government services. And there was someone who talked about the 911 mentality, that we think we don't have to prepare, we can just call someone and they'll take care of us, or we don't have individual responsibility for our disaster preparedness or our disaster recovery. Michael, maybe you can talk a little bit about, especially with the changeover in the administration, how much the private sector needs to be involved in disaster preparedness and how much we really do need public services to help us out in the aftermath of an earthquake and how important that is to the resiliency of a city.
Yeah, thank you. Don't misunderstand me. I think that the role of the private sector is critical, but the role of every sector is critical. We can't do without anybody when we're in a
disaster situation like that. I think the thing that worries me is that if we keep on moving towards private sector solutions, then only people who can afford the solutions will actually benefit. Those of us who can't afford it, and there's most of us in this room, will be left out on a limb. So consequently, I'd like to see a much greater effort of preparedness on everybody's part. If you can afford to pay for superior services because you need something special, I mean, that's your privilege because of that's the money that you have. What I'm much more concerned about is the baseline response for all people, not the fact that somebody who lives in San Diego can afford to buy their own fire truck and crew. I mean, that's not a society solution. Therefore, I think the other piece of the puzzle that comes in, and we are seeing a lot of this around the table right now, is leadership. Leadership in many different dimensions. Leadership in terms of education, leadership in terms of information, leadership in coffee clutches in neighborhoods where people can actually talk about what they're doing. I mean, I think these are all very good. But I still come back to the situation. I mean, that gentleman, Viragosa, wrote a prominent piece in introducing this book. I mean, he and all other politicians have to get a grip on the situation. They have to, in fact, listen to the people who have already spoken around this panel about how to deal with it. We have singularly failed at many, many levels, I think, in the public sector to actually deal with that in recent decades. And if we are going to succeed, and if everything that we've been recommended around the table right now is going to work, then the public sector has to do something. It's always struck me, and I thought Dennis would actually say more about this. In recent years, the science, it seems to me, has dramatically increased in terms of our knowledge about earthquakes. I mean, this kind of visual display is much more important than many other things. But there's still this gap. There's still this dichotomy that David referred to. We've got terrific science. It's not actually going to predict it yet, but it's getting better and better all the time. But then there's the rest of us who just sort of sit here and think, okay, it's not going to happen to me. It's going to happen to somebody else. I'm going to be fine. It's not going to be fine. We can do all that we can do privately as individuals. We need the help and wealth and leadership of the private sector to pull together, but we also need the public sector to make sure that those resources which are available for helping us in the survival and recovery periods are actually available to all people. I have a lot more to say in terms of services and so on, but maybe we can come back to that.
You bring up this word leadership that I think is very important this week because we have a new president, and I think we can all agree, whatever our politics, that last few years have been silent in science in general. There's been much less information to the public, and I know there's a big commitment in the Obama administration to science, which also, David, I know you have something to say about really facing up to disaster and facing up to the possibility that something could happen.
Well, since you brought up the the administrations, I think, you know, the last several years, just as we've lived in a culture of fear, now, if we'll see how it all goes, but if Obama walks the walk, we are moving away from a culture of fear. And I think this sort of returns to something that Mariana was saying. I think, you know, fear is the opposite of empowerment. If you operate out of, if you scare people, or if you just say, look, this thing is coming and it's going to be a disaster, people also stop listening. They roll up. They don't want to deal with it because it's terrifying. It's overwhelming. It's beyond our ability to comprehend it. So people back away. If you provide people with things that they can do, or again, with a positive message, not that it's not going to be horrible or that it's not going to be dangerous or all these kind of things, but that there is something on the other side. You know, when I was doing research for the book, I found a passage by someone reporting on a Native American woman who's describing the Fort Tejon earthquake, who said it felt like the end of the world. This was the last big Southern California San Andreas quake in 1857. She said it felt like the end of the world. And I'm sure it did feel like the end of the world, but it wasn't the end of the world. And for me, as someone who tends to think in apocalyptic terms, it was a really eye-opening statement because it made me realize that the apocalypse never actually is the apocalypse in some way. I mean, there are personal apocalypses, there are all these, but the world probably largely never ends. I mean, we'll see. But there's something that comes afterwards. And so I think if you can empower people, if you can give them stories, even if the story is, hey, I had an earthquake drill at school, that's really great, I had an earthquake drill at work, what was it like? Even if that's the story, you give people a sense of empowerment or power over the circumstance. Not to say that it's not going to happen, but to say, here are the steps you can take. Here's a way of being proactive as opposed to reactive. It seems to me that fear is reactive and empowerment is proactive. And I think culturally, hopefully, we're moving into a society, or we're shifting as a society into that kind of perspective. But I think that that is a way to think in terms of, certainly in terms of earthquakes or any kind of natural disaster, or, you know, frankly, in terms of anything.
And that facing up to it starts at the top, and that's what we're hoping to see, and we believe we're seeing in the new administration.
So far, so good.
Yeah.
It's been a good first 36 hours.
One interesting, yeah, right. 36 hours. One interesting nugget about that apocalypse is I've been reading a lot by this scientist named Amos Noor, who I know you know, and he points out that the word Armageddon comes from the city of Megiddo, and it's a very active seismic zone where many earthquakes happened over many millennia, and many civilizations were buried in them. So the whole idea of apocalypse may actually start with
He wrote that. It was a really fascinating book that he wrote that came out over the summer.
Yeah. So I know a lot of people's thinking about disaster changed in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. And in taking into account that Los Angeles is geographically much different than New Orleans, and a hurricane is meteorologically, scientifically much different than an earthquake, how did our thinking about disaster preparedness and recovery and resiliency of cities change after watching what happened in New Orleans after Katrina? Maybe, Dennis, you could start that out.
Oh, I'm happy to. Emergency response to Hurricane Katrina was the largest emergency response failure in the history of the United States of America. It failed at the local level, it failed at the state level, and it failed at the presidential and federal level. It embarrassed me. It embarrassed everyone who has any formal role related to emergency management. And I wouldn't generalize a thing from that particular event to any that came before it or any that might come in the future. Now, having said that, it scared people to death. And I think people responded to that. Government responded to it. I know the state of California responded to it as follows. We can't expect the federal government to help us. We better take care of it ourselves. So if anything, from a reaction point of view, except for the poor people who had to experience directly and indirectly that catastrophe, it may have provided an impetus or renewed interest in doing more themselves at state levels and local levels and individuals. So that's what I think.
And how does that shift in thinking? Michael, maybe this is a question for you. How does that change what gets done if more individuals are taking responsibility, if more state and local governments and also corporations are taking responsibility for preparing and for rebuilding? Does that influence who gets helped? That does that influence what gets rebuilt in the aftermath of a disaster?
Sure, it does. I mean, think about Katrina and think about Florida. Okay, if the president is your brother, Florida gets everything it needs. In that recent disasters that they had there, that was a little while after Katrina. Katrina, we suffered. President's brother was the governor in Florida, and they got declared an emergency zone within a nanosecond, and they got all the assistance that they needed. And everybody looks back and says, well, didn't Jeb Bush do wonderful work? Of course he did. He had the full force of the federal government behind him. So we can learn a lot. I'm a little bit surprised by what Dennis was saying. Because if anything, we can generalize, and we have generalized, terror, the simple terror response to seeing that happen without any assistance coming. Secondly, the lies that we were told Not so long after the Katrina, I went searching for my favorite photograph from Katrina. It was a woman, I think, floating upside face down, so you couldn't really tell, but she seemed to be wearing a dress, and she was drowned near a bridge, and that was, for me, was the sort of the iconic photograph. I went searching for it. I couldn't find it. I finally found it on a Yahoo site, and there were 125 other photographs on that site. The image that I wanted was about a half a postage stamp in size, and when you blew it up, it completely disintegrated. It was not meant to be reproduced and actually seen. On that site with 125 photographs, there were 55 photographs of George Bush and of the 40 photographs of his cabinet, including Condoleezza Rice, Rumsfeld in army fatigues. Quite why he was wearing army fatigues and why he was on the site concerned with Katrina, I don't know. So there was a lot to learn, I think, from that, including the fact that we really can't rely on that government service. And we do generalize from it. We do generalize it in terms of terror, and we are at least beginning now, I think, to regeneralize it in terms of what we all need to do about it. If I can just say one other thing to make sure I'm not being overly glum about this. The specific case about Los Angeles interests me in terms of, particularly because of its geography, which is to say it's a very large city. It covers 14, well, the region as a whole, the five-county region, covers 14,000 miles of urbanized area, and it has 177 cities in it. It's extremely decentralized. So we're not looking at a conventional city like New York or Chicago with everything, or Tokyo perhaps, where everything is really strongly biased towards a core. It's in this kind of geography that I actually find some hope for this situation that I don't want to lose track of in this conversation either. Because if all the services and all the people are decentralized as they are, then I'm hoping that not all centers are going to get knocked out by however bad the earthquake is, with the exception of really extreme earthquakes, of course. So we have something inbuilt into our urban geography work here, which is inherently positive in terms of our possible responses. That said, I also don't want to forget that there are 177 cities, five counties, maybe 1,000 special service districts. The politics of the situation is not coordinated. And if we are going to turn to even to our local government to help us under those circumstances, then the problem of coordination amongst all those agencies is simply going to compound matters. So we've got a very peculiar situation here in terms of what we specifically can do locally. Because we have got this decentralized population, we have this decentralized system of services, hospitals, emergency networks, and so on. Yet at the same time, we have no real ability to coordinate amongst them.
I think in the 1985 earthquake in Mexico City, that idea of everything being centralized was what turned it into a catastrophe, right?
Can I jump in on
yes.
something?
Yes.
Michael, I think this is a really interesting point. I don't think that there's a real... I mean, I think there are certain correlations between Katrina and what could happen here. I think there are a couple of fundamental differences, both one being physical and one being sociological. The physical one being that even if there had been some kind of coordinated governmental effort, which there wasn't, the fact that the city was flooded and it was very difficult to get relief into the city is something that wouldn't happen in an earthquake, because although things would be knocked down, there would be ways to land. There would be ways to land helicopters and such. Also, I think, frankly, and this comes back to, we can flat out call it racism, is that New Orleans is a poor city. Major economy is tourism, largely black. Southern California as a region is a major economic driver of the U.S. economy. So even under an inept administration, and this may be my denial at work or my own internal optimism, I always felt that in a similar way to Florida, although with a less of a family connection, that they would get help to Southern California because they couldn't afford to lose it. Mm. Whereas New Orleans, I think, less essential to the larger national picture.
Lucy, I think.
And I don't mean that I feel
that
way.
I'm going to get in here first.
It's political.
I think there's several things to talk about in comparison. As Dennis said, it was failure at all levels. I mean, I heard that the head of emergency management of New Orleans was in jail when the hurricane hit. That tends to impair your ability to respond. I think an important thing that came out of that was that people saw the possibility of failure to respond. I think that's really been a message coming into Southern California. It could happen. We aren't guaranteed to get out of this. And some people go into denial and know our emergency management is so much better. And granted, there's really good people there, and as far as I know, none of them are in jail. But it's also, and in many ways, we have some of the best emergency management in the country. At the same time, it's hard to keep it up sometimes. And I think one advantage to Katrina, I used to joke that I never thought a hurricane would disrupt a seismologist's life, and then I had to do like 100 interviews in the week after it happened. Because people saw the connection very clearly. And I think it helped get a bit more re-energizing within our emergency management community, because it's been a long time since the last big earthquake. But the other really important piece that I think happened here is that once you've allowed that picture that we could not be able to respond, and then you go and look at this earthquake, and I think that that was one of the things that our modeling did, raised the possibility that maybe we can't respond. Not the earthquake itself, but the fires that it'll generate. There just aren't that many fire engines in Southern California, and there's going to be a limit to how many we could have. And we got one of the emergency managers that we worked with from at the state level said, you know, this has changed the nature of the discussion, because you've shown us that we can't respond to this earthquake. Therefore, mitigation, it now becomes the only option. And we've never been able to get people to talk about mitigation. It's not nearly as sexy as response. But now they recognize that it's the only way to go. And if that really has changed that thinking, that's huge, because I think that's what I get to. This is not, there's going to be a scale, and it's not that unlikely, the earthquake that we just can't respond to if we don't do a lot more to change the outcome before it happens.
Well, I knew going in that 1 hour with this panel was going to seem like 10 minutes, and that hour is over. And I'd like to open it up to questions in the audience. Justin here has a microphone, and he'll bring it around to, let's start with this woman in the blue in the second row from the back.
I'd like to thank Dr. Lucy for being such a calming influence to all of us. Really, you can't even know, you know, what you've done for us, really. But here's my question. I work in one of these high-rise buildings that right around this building that would fall on us here if it went down. I read in the literature after the shakeout that some of these major high-rise buildings might collapse. Are you at liberty to tell us which ones those are?
I would if I could, but I can't. What we did is we took a particular building that had actually been damaged in 1994, and we had the complete information of exactly how it was built, and therefore we're able to make a numerical model of it. And a structural engineering team at Caltech took that numerical model of the building, took our numerical model of the earthquake that was shown with pretty colors here, they took the numbers, put the earthquake into that building at many different locations around Southern California. In fact, we did a 2-kilometer grid, and it fell down in most places in the LA Basin. There are some important points, though. That's a pre-1994 type of building. There are things that we learned about how steel behaves and the nature of welding process, actually, that affected the behavior. So we don't build buildings like that anymore. And the post-94 building did not fall down in almost everywhere. But we did it's a theoretical building. To know whether what it applies to a particular building requires creating the numerical model of that building and then believing it. And, you know, so it's going to take a process to take this information. And, you know, this was information that was pretty well rejected when it was first done with a theoretical earthquake. And partly the process of validating and vetting the seismology that went into our model helped a lot in getting the structural engineering community to look at this. And we got a team of structural engineers to evaluate the study and got a consensus statement that the collapse of pre-1994 welded steel moment frame buildings is a credible scenario. But that's really big that we got the engineers to say that. And now we're going to have to work with that. I'm actually going to the California Building Officials annual meeting in 2 weeks because they want to talk more about it. It'll happen like other building code changes have happened in California over a long time and with a lot of argument and partially there.
And the big thing to remember is that no building code in the world is retroactive. So your code is, your building is only as good as the code that was in place when your building was built. There's probably something you can do to make your home safer too, unless it was built after 1997.
Right, more questions? Let's take this man up in the back. Or that's fine. Right, sure, that's fine too.
There are, I'm sure question for Lucy. I think I've heard you say that the probability of this San Andreas event is about 2% per year or something on that order. I'm wondering how that compares in the hazard from having smaller quakes on local faults that are closer to us, and how that compares with the risk of this big one on the San Andreas.
Well, according to Dennis, this doesn't matter. But anyway, the 2% per year is about what the San Andreas is. Depending on where you live in Southern California, you have more or less faults near you. We average a damaging earthquake in Los Angeles about every 20 years, somewhere in Southern California about every 5 years. And so the problem is those are all different places, and there's only a much smaller group that's there. I think the important thing is that this is a different type of experience. I mean, Northridge was very damaging to the people who were on top of it, but it didn't shake our fundamental social structure because it was confined, and we had the resources to handle it. What we're talking about with this, the San Andreas earthquake, which is unfortunately, I mean, 2% per year is the highest probability of any fault in the United States. And that's it's an event that would really strain the resources of our whole community. And, you know, the possibility that Southern California won't be what it is now at a fundamental level after that event. With the message that it depends on what decisions we all choose to make between now and the time the earthquake happens.
All right. The woman in the green in the second row from the back. There we go.
This question is for you, Lucy. I feel like I know you. I've seen you on television so many times. I've lived in L.A. all my life. My question is about the 94 Northridge quake and then the subsequent earthquake 1 year later in Japan that was almost to the moment. They being us and the Kobe earthquake, the place in Japan, the same latitude. Has anyone ever looked at longitudes and latitudes, or is it just coincidence?
Yes, and it's coincidence. We've actually done quite a bit of statistical analysis, and mostly the catalog is random, except for aftershocks. One earthquake makes another earthquake more likely. Mostly it happens really nearby, but it's a die-off with distance, and if you have a big enough earthquake, it affects the rate of earthquakes all around the world. So like when we have a magnitude 9, when we had the Sumatran earthquake, there were a lot of earthquakes around Asia afterwards, and that's probably some level of triggering. But that's really the only phenomenon, and it only lasts that dies off with time quite rapidly. And otherwise, it really is a random coincidence, and it's sometimes instructive to watch the earthquake catalog for the world. There's a magnitude 7 about once a month somewhere in the world, mostly under the water.
Right. The panel is becoming Ask the Seismologist. The man, third row from the front in the middle section.
Yes, I'm a professional engineer. And I'm also heavily engaged in the Budget Finance Committee in Los Angeles. And one of the things that has dismayed me very much is something that you people in the audience can do something about, and that is the denial is not just people, it's also the city of Los Angeles. We have three great faults that run through the city of Los Angeles, any one of which, if it let loose, AIG or any other insurance company would go completely bankrupt. You would not get any money from it. So people would be so angry, they would go back to the city and say, why did you let that building be built? And you have to remember that 55% of the people in Los Angeles live in rented buildings. So that means you are at risk. And you have no control over it because you didn't get to design that building. So you would go back and sue the city. One building in Hollywood, which is under construction right now, if that building fails and it's on a major, one of the major faults, would cost the city $2 billion in indemnity. $2 billion. Considering that our whole budget is only $7 billion, we would have no more library. We probably have no more police department. This is a major concern of mine, and the city is just coming to grips with it. It's something that we have to consider. And my question to Ms. Jones is, of course, I've studied very carefully the stuff because I am a Caltech graduate. I went to school there when Professor Richter was getting up his Richter scale. And what I want to know is, when Krishnan came up with his statistics on how many buildings would be damaged, why was that downplayed and cut down in the amount that was advertised? Because it seems to me that people would be more concerned and go after their governments a little more if they knew that they were at risk because the building codes were not going to provide safety for the people that lived in them.
There were several reasons on how to handle that. Professor Krishnan proposed 10 buildings, but it's a very flexible number. I mean, because it's we don't have the detailed plans, et cetera, et cetera. Our review panel of structural engineers proposed that it could be zero. We came to a consensus of 5. The reality is it could be anywhere from zero to a big number, a high percentage, and there's enough hypotheticals. I did choose, as we portrayed the scenario in the press, to not emphasize that aspect for a couple of reasons. One is that it's not very empowering. It's very difficult to get people to see what they can do about how a steel frame building is constructed. And I wanted to make sure we got it to the building officials. I think it's much more important that I take it up to Calbo, actually, in terms of leading to change in how it's handled. The other aspect is that although there are real risks with these buildings, there are bigger risks with many older buildings. And we chose to make more of a point about what are called non-ductile reinforced concrete buildings, which everyone agrees are going to collapse. Many of those are tall buildings, and those led to 20,000 dead in Turkey in the earthquake in 1999. And there's 1,000 of them known to be problem types in the city of Los Angeles. And we wanted to push at that because I think that getting legislation requiring retrofitting of those buildings is a more achievable goal than getting a real change in how the steel frame buildings are handled right now. So I made a personal choice that I wanted a simpler message and decided to really focus on the ones that I thought we could get the biggest life savings out of.
Justin, in the second row, this left section.
Thank you. This question is not for Lucy. And forgive me for possibly bringing the level of this discourse down to the ground zero of personal ignorance, but when you asked, were people prepared here, I didn't see a whole lot of hands. So I address the panel at large. What are the 3 basic things I need to do to be prepared for an earthquake, part one? And 2, what are 2 things that I can do to speak to my immediate community about those prepared ideas?
But I want to answer it.
David, are you, Dennis, do you have something to say about that?
Yeah, sure. But
okay. Go ahead. I know what I.
There aren't 3. There are 7. There are 7 categories of ways to get ready for earthquakes. And each of them contain multiple steps and actions. If you added up all the individual actions, you'd actually conclude, I bet, what I did, and that is there are 42 things all of us should do. But the first thing is, number one, and it costs no money, it's free, is learn what you need to know about how to get ready. And that's available almost every place you turn. And if you want to go to daretoprepare.org, it's there, or if you want to look at putting down roots in earthquake country, it's been there for a long time, and a new version of that document just came out. Those are the two best places I can think of. So that's how I'd answer that question. So I would begin by learning what it is you need to do to get ready, and then open your mouth and talk about it with people in your life.
David, do you have something to say about this as well?
I think that's a great answer. You know, small bills, because they won't make change.
And you won't be able to use your credit card if there's no electricity.
Right. More than half a tank of gas. This is something I learned from Lucy.
People like to talk about the kits, but
I don't have a kit, except for I've been given some.
I thought of another important one. If you're on the east end of the San Andreas, enough food and water for 7 to 10 days, not 72 hours.
I will say the two things I changed because of writing the scenario. One was to store more water than I had been storing, because the conclusion is it's going to take up to 6 months to get water into all the pipes in Southern California after the earthquake. The second thing I did is get a fire extinguisher and make sure my kids know how to use it. The thing that scared me out of this is the fires. We know that earthquakes start fires. There were 110 fires that got called to the fire department for Northridge. But if you extrapolate it from that small area in Northridge to this much bigger area with this event, it becomes 1,600. And we don't have that many fire engines in Southern California. And the fires are going to be out of control. We end up saying they'll double the losses, and that's without a Santa Ana.
I'm really getting worried.
And you want to move yet?
let's watch the scenario.
Justin, in the front row of this back section, if you turn around, maroon sweater. She's had her hand up for a while. So.
Well, thank you all for being here. I have a question concerning the future. I understand that in 5 years, this whole western United States is going to be a permanent drought area. How are we going to get the fires out?
Your premise is not necessarily true. We don't know what global change is going to bring to Southern California. I'll say I know global change is happening, but the models and details of any one region depend upon a lot of variables, so we really aren't certain. On the long run, it's got to be the really big issue that we're dealing with is how to face fires, and if we get to that level of drought, we need to leave.
And I think your question is fascinating, but it veers into the area of our water supply, which I don't think we're going to be able to get our heads around in 12 minutes. But.
And I just want to add, the question of how are we going to put the fires out is with us even without a drought.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In the blue shirt in this left-hand section, my left hand.
Thank you very much. When we had the Southern California shakeout event, I was somewhat surprised, but more so disappointed that not every city in the LA area actually participated in the event. Are you aware of any legislation to require cities to participate in these types of drills, or that will require cities to better prepare themselves for responses that undoubtedly will either be limited or non-existent from state and federal agencies?
At this point, it is voluntary, and I know that there have been enough when they participate, they aren't given resources to do so, and the participation in the exercises over time has been going down as people get frustrated dealing with the Homeland Security operation. And the shakeout really turned that around. In part, you know, there was sort of real science. There was all this other event. There was the whole public side that got that was by far the largest participation in the formal exercise that's ever happened by several, you know, factor of several times.
And if I may just add, don't think that a city's ability to respond to an emergency is contingent on participating in an exercise like this. Emergency preparedness is the best in the world in the state of California, and it exists independent of participating in these big exercises. I still would encourage everyone to participate in the exercises, but it is independent of that.
Right, over there, sure.
Having said that, what's the plan to repeat the shakeout exercise?
Over my dead body. Not as it happened at this time. However, there is a lot. We're getting a lot of people wanting it. And I think that probably what will happen is we're looking to get the schools together on doing it all on one day. And sometime in the fall, because traditionally we did it in April, so the kids would be in school all year, and then just before they left, we'd teach them what to do in earthquakes and then send them home, and trying to move it. And so I think that that's likely to happen. The schools saw a lot of benefit to having it all at the same time. They learned, it helped them understand it better. And I think once we get that in place, I think the corporations are likely to join us, the ones that, you know, sort of do a drill every year, doing it at that time, it fed on each other. The hospitals, it's going to depend on legislation. They are required by law to do things, and they're required to do all sorts of things, and the legislators, the regulators tend to do it at different times. The Golden Guardian, the official government part of it, is not going to happen in 2009 because they're getting over onto a federal schedule and they're going to be going back to doing terrorist event in 2010 instead of earthquakes.
David, did you have something to say about that as well? I noticed you.
I didn't. I mean, okay. All I would say is I think that actually in some ways the preparation for a terrorist event and the preparation for an earthquake are relatively similar in terms of, not that terrorism is random, but I think its effect is random in the sense that you don't know that it's coming. Someone's planning it, unlike an earthquake. But when it actually happens, you don't know that it's going to happen. You don't know when it's going to happen until it happens. And in terms of any kind of event that would compromise, say, food and water supply and all those kind of things, I think you have to prepare in a similar kind of way. And I think psychologically you have to prepare in a similar kind of way for the uncertainty of it.
Michael, you hinted in your comments about Villaraigosa and perhaps the some denial or not really taking seriously the extent of the problem on the part of our public officials that this man's question just before that brought to mind. Do you think that may have affected some cities and communities' participation in the shakeout, just unwillingness to face it?
I think without doubt. It's always a problem in Los Angeles, Southern California, generally to get 177 cities together and on the same day doing the same thing. But there's just plain orderliness affecting a lot of cities in lots of ways. I mean, there are so many examples of this, especially, for example, around services for homeless people in the region. A fraction of the cities in the region actually do have formal programs to help homeless people. Something like 88, 90% of cities don't have them. Everybody agrees it's a good thing, but they're not prepared to spend any money on it. So getting everybody to collaborate in that respect is difficult. Another personal example, I mean, my sister-in-law lives in a state which is quite some distance from here, which probably should remain nameless, but she's having foreclosure troubles, and she's gone to her county to ask for foreclosure help, but the people who run the county there don't believe in federal government and don't believe in federal government intervention, so they're refusing all assistance to people who live in that county because they just are against it themselves. Under those circumstances, if you can't get everybody involved, I mean, what you actually got involved was a miracle, because people just won't do it. They'll just do what they want to do. It's just human nature, especially human political nature. I congratulate you on the success that you were successful, to the extent that you were successful.
And maybe I can, on that note of participation and that question about the shakeout and its replication, what was fantastic to be part of as one of the committee people, which included the city of Los Angeles, and I'd like to say that Councilman Greg Smith and John Bowery, who's in the back, showed, you know, some of the best leadership from a city official they had a center stage conference during that shakeout week with a lot of discussion about policy change happened with a lot of our distinguished panel here. But back to the participation and the magic of shakeout, I think there was a quality of grassroots, contagious enthusiasm to want to be part of this, that you were not mandated to be part of it, but that we observed with all of the members that made this effort possible. And I think that's one of the ingredients that made it successful.
I think the shakeout also coincided with a major weekend of fires in Los Angeles, if I'm not mistaken. I missed a couple of the events because of...
Yeah, it actually changed. Part of the formal Golden Guardian exercises were canceled because they were responding to the fires. They started the night after the shakeout day.
Right. Okay. Is there someone who hasn't asked a question? The man in the green shirt up here.
For some reason, I just feel it's not enough. The shake, it was marvelous, but the shakeout, I guess the question is, is there more of a linkage or a network between what was just done with the shakeout and the emergency management that we're hearing is so well in California, but we haven't really seen it. I mean, I'm asking the linkage between the populace response and the quote unquote professional emergency management infrastructure, so that we can test some of the assumptions.
Well, this was the first time we'd ever tried to do the emergency response exercise in a public way. I mean, they've been going on for a long time, and that was one of the things I said to them was like, yeah, you're doing this great job, but nobody knows it. And let's go and showcase it. So I think that they're, you know, the emergency managers have worked close. I mean, they've been working a lot with us. They were a critical part of creating the scenario. They're around, and they are really committed, and there's a lot of things about the way it's structured in California that are really excellent. I just wish that somehow we could, you know, politics couldn't affect it, and... the level of commitment stays constant in spite of the fact there hasn't been an earthquake for 15 years. That's actually a significant problem.
If I may just contribute one more point, and that is the real gift of the shakeout was the scenario, and that will continue to keep giving because it profiles that what we're getting ready for isn't your grandfather's earthquake. It's a class different than that. And so some of the biggest benefits of having done the scenario and then the shakeout to first present it may have yet to emerge. And so having that document alive and available and disseminated and discussed in forums like this itself is a benefit.
And we are going on, actually. The next scenario being developed is going to be about major California winter storms, which I didn't realize rival hurricanes in their disaster potential doesn't happen very often. It's like the earthquakes. But 150 years ago, we had a flood that devastated the state. Could happen again.
And the science that went into modeling that earthquake for the shakeout is fascinating, and it's very well discussed in the LA earthquake source book. So if you want to know more, I feel like we've just scratched the surface of the fault, and there's much more in the book. Thank you all for being here. Thank you very much for your time.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.